Okay, so I think we can probably start this evening's talk. So tonight I'm going to talk about mostly about the idea of right view and about different aspects of right view and even how to be able to develop this idea of right view. And right view is actually is one of those aspects of Buddhism which are very important. You may know, if you know your Buddhism well, you know you have the Noble Eightfold Path. And of course, the Noble Eightfold Path starts off with right view, right? This is the first, the very beginning part of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path is a conditioned sequence of things, a conditioned sequence of mental factors or things that you're supposed to practice all the way up. And because it is conditioned, and right view is the first one of these factors, it means that right view is very important. Right view is what makes the rest of the path possible, right? If the first condition is in place, the rest of the path happens as a consequence of the first condition. So for this reason, it is actually very important and very useful to reflect on this idea of right view a little bit. This is the first thing. The other thing about right view, sometimes people seem to think that, you know, right view, either you have it or you haven't got it. It's like an entity that you possess or you don't possess it. But I think, even though that is easy to think in that way, I don't think it isn't quite like that. The idea of right view is something that you can develop, is something that you can over time. Your idea of what is right view and how to look at things will change over time. And you can actually develop this idea of right view. Right view is something that can be enhanced or it can be improved upon. And the idea here is to make right view, to make it into a force, and make it into power in your practice. You actually have to reflect on this thing and you have to develop it in the right direction. And when it develops in the right direction, it becomes a very powerful foundation and a very powerful basis for the whole practice of the Buddhist path. So the question is, how can we develop right view? How can we actually reflect in such a way that this foundation stone becomes more powerful, right? Becomes more of the thing which drives the rest of the practice. And the things I want to talk about today, the first thing I want to talk about is, if you know the formula for right view on the Buddhist path, one of the basic ideas of right view is that there are people in the world. It's often called ascetics. The Pali word is samana. It means like ascetics or recluses, people who have left the ordinary worldly life. And it says there are these ascetics in the world who have right practice and who have right conduct. And these ascetics who have right practice and right conduct, they teach you. First of all, they realize for themselves, right? And what they realize, very interestingly, is that there is this world and there is the other world. And then once they realize that, they proclaim it to the world at large, to other people. And this is like the foundation stone of right view. That the idea that there are these ascetics, these spiritual people, who realize a picture which is broader, which is larger than the ordinary picture that we have of the world. And of course you can see why this is so important, right? And why do people come to a Buddhist center such as Dhammadhokka in the first place? And of course the idea people come here is because maybe this Buddhist teaching has something to teach me that can make my life better, make the life of people around me better, can sort of enhance everything, right? This is the reason why we come here. So there's an idea there that the Buddha or the Buddhist teachings, they have something, there's something in them which is powerful, that has the ability to change our lives for the better and do something positive for us. If you haven't got that feeling, you wouldn't be here in the first place, right? There's a sense there that there's something to be learned and to be understood from the Buddhist teachings. So this idea that there are ascetics and there are people in the world, and of course that the first one of these ascetics is the Buddha himself, right? And then you have all the disciples of the Buddha, all those people who have practiced in his footsteps and who have realized the same kind of thing. And this is, and perhaps also certain people outside of the Buddha's teachings. And these are the people who realize these things, and these are the people that you then have a certain confidence in. So how is it? How does this confidence in the Buddha, how does the confidence in spiritual people or ascetics in general, how does this arise? How can we do something to improve that? Can we do something to enhance our confidence? Because the more powerful that confidence, remember that now we're talking about right view, right? The first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So the more powerful that confidence is, that there are these ascetics who have a larger view of the world, who have a greater understanding that we have, the more powerful your practice is going to be. So how can we enhance this? And this is, in a sense, this topic is really all about what you might call spiritual authority. So in other words, who do we trust? Who has spiritual authority in the world? Who should we listen to? Who are worthy of our trust and confidence in this way? And the Buddha in the suttas tackles these questions directly. And he says that what we should do, the spiritual path basically is about overcoming the defilements of the mind, right? Becoming more pure, becoming more good-hearted, becoming a more wholesome person with more integrity in our life. So if that is what the spiritual path is about, then those people worthy of confidence are precisely those people who don't have these defilements, right? People who have put these things aside. So the way that we decide whether somebody is worthy of confidence is by watching them, seeing their conduct. Are they pure? Are they angry? Are they kind? Do they have loving kindness? Have they got compassion? Have they got understanding? Or are they angry, greedy, confused, stupid, restless, and all these other kind of things? And that is what the Buddha says we should do. And those people who have those good qualities, that is where basically we should place our confidence. That is already a good start, right? Because sometimes you know that there are certain people who obviously are not worthy of a confidence because they are greedy and they are angry and there's all kind of problems with them. But also, sometimes it is hard to know, right? I mean, I know people, I brought this topic up previously, and somebody said, yeah, but you know, we see you guys, we see monks coming in here once a week, and sometimes the nuns come here and they give a talk, and we never see them again, right? How do we know what kind of qualities you actually have? Maybe you're real scallywags when you go back to the monastery here. Maybe there's a kind of a show you put on for an hour, and then you go back, you read the dodgy characters afterwards. Maybe. You really don't know, do you? This is the problem. So, and the Buddha also realized that. He realized it's very hard sometimes to judge somebody who is a little bit remote. And this is the whole idea of being a monastic. It's precisely, the idea is to be a little bit remote, right? To withdraw a little bit from society. Because that is what makes the practice possible in the first place. So, is there another way of deciding who is worthy of confidence and who is worthy of being listened to as a spiritual authority? And the Buddha says, well, another way of doing that is to listen to those people who live in the forest, those people who live withdrawn from the ordinary worldly life. Those people are worthy of confidence. And why is that? Well, the reason is because if you are withdrawn from the ordinary world, if you live life as a forest monastic or a forest ascetic, well, you cannot really enjoy the pleasures of the world, right? And because you can't enjoy the pleasures of the world, it means that you are practicing for something else. You're finding your happiness somewhere else, and you're withdrawing from those defilements that exist in the world. So there is a certain confidence that you can have about somebody living in the forest, that either they have already realized something higher, or at the very least, they are practicing to move away from those defilements and from those pleasures that are the worldly pleasures. That is a general statement. It's not always true. None of these things are always going to be true. That is a general statement that the Buddha makes. That's quite powerful, isn't it? It's a very simple kind of criteria, this idea that whether somebody lives in the forest or doesn't. And the Buddha says that is enough to already have some idea of what is going on and some idea of where you can place your confidence. And actually, when you start reading the word of the Buddha, it is actually quite surprising the extent to which he elevates the idea of living in the forest and how important that is in the Buddha's teachings, in particular for the monastic Sangha. I talked about this here before, but I think it is perhaps worthwhile repeating this. And to give you some examples, this is just one example I just gave now. Another well-known example is, maybe not well-known, but perhaps well-known to here, perhaps, and that is one of the discourses of the Buddha. The Buddha says that he is walking around, and he's walking around, and as he's walking around, he's seeing the monks in different places, right? And he sees one monk sitting on the outskirts of a village, and he's sitting really straight, right? Looks very impressive, completely still. Looks like he's sitting in a good state of samadhi. Obviously, his meditation is going very well, right? So, what do you think the Buddha says about that? This is kind of the counterintuitive things that you sometimes read in the suttas. And the Buddha says, "I'm not happy with that monk," right? You think, he said, "Wow, that monk is doing really well." He doesn't say that. He says, "I'm not happy with that monk." And the reason he says that is because that monk, being so close to the village, even though his meditation is good now, it is very likely that he will be disturbed later on because he's too close to civilization, too close to where all the action is. He will be disturbed, and then he will lose the meditation he had before. So the whole point here of the Buddhist path is not what you have, it's where you're heading. It's about moving in the right direction. And if you haven't got the circumstances to support moving in the right direction, you're likely to lose what you already have. And then the Buddha goes on, and then he says, "Well, here I see a monk in the forest, someone away from the village." And this monk is like nodding, right, sitting in meditation, nodding. So really tired and really kind of, you know, looks very unimpressive, right, nodding away. And the Buddha says, again, very counterintuitively, "I'm happy with that monk. This monk is doing well. Why is he doing well? Because he's sitting in the forest, because he's sitting away from kind of civilization and all the action. He will be able to overcome that tiredness. He will overcome that problem of his, and then his meditation will take off," right? That's quite remarkable. It's very counterintuitive. Often we talk about who has good meditation and who hasn't. But the Buddha actually says, more important than that is actually whether you are in the forest or whether you are in the village or the outskirts of the village. So again, very important importance of the forest dwelling, how that actually is kind of lifted up and praised by the Buddha himself. And the last place, or the other place I was going to talk about, is where the Buddha talks about the qualities that will preserve the Dhamma for future generations and for the future. And he talks about seven different qualities, I'm not going to talk about all the seven, but one of those qualities is that the Sangha, the monastic Sangha, dwells in the forest. When the monastic Sangha dwells in the forest, this is what will uplift and hold and keep the Dhamma and keep Buddhism alive and well for the future, as long as that happens. And again, the idea is the same, right? When you are away from the village, when you're away from society, you're withdrawing from sensuality, you're withdrawing from the sensual world. And when you're withdrawing from the sensual world, that is where meditation can start to actually happen. So, this is how the Buddha praises the dwelling in the forest. And it is useful, I think, to actually just, I want to talk about some of these monks that I, and nuns as well, that I know about, who dwell in the forest and dwell far away, just to share with you some of the inspiration that I have had over the years, just by hearing some of these stories. And one of these stories, one of these monks, this is a monk in Sri Lanka. And he is not very well known, and if I mention his name, you probably never have heard of this person before. But he lived way out in the jungle somewhere, way, way far away in the Sri Lankan jungles. And Sri Lanka is one of those countries in the world where there still is a lot of really dense forest, right? If you go to Thailand these days, which is another staunch Buddhist country, there's very little forest left. But in a place like Sri Lanka, you actually find a lot of forest. And this monk was one of these who really withdrew into the forest, far away, right? And every day he would go on alms round, and when he walked on alms round, he would walk from like 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 kilometers, depending on where he stayed. And then he would go into the village and get his food, and then go back again into the forest, right? And he was always in the forest. And he would have a kuti, like a hut in this forest. And this hut he had was built on stilts. And then it only had three walls, right? The one wall was missing here. And the idea was that this was supposed to be like a cave. And a cave, of course, has an entrance. So you would have no wall on one side. So imagine that. You're living in the jungle, right? And of course, in the jungle, there's all kinds of wild animals, snakes and monkeys and elephants and all kinds of insects, of course. And he would only have three walls. So very often, you know, when he would wake up in the morning, there would be like a snake sort of curled up against him, right? This is kind of what life was like for a monk like that. Or there would be some other kind of animal sleeping at his feet or something like that. Because this is what the jungle is like in that area. And then once a year, he would come out of the forest and we would meet with the other monks in the area and we would have Dhamma discussions, right? And of course, everybody is very keen on meeting a monk like this. A monk like this, someone who only comes out of the forest once a year to have Dhamma discussion. You can imagine what kind of mental development that kind of monk has. So everybody is very inspired. Everybody wants to talk to this monk. And then they have a Dhamma discussion which goes on for about 5 or 6 days. They talk obviously about meditation, right, about insight, how to achieve all these things. Everybody wants to hear, have a piece of this monk because of his practice. And then he, after 6 days, he disappears back into the forest again, right? Almost without a trace, going back into the forest. And that's how he lived his life. And he's still alive today, and he's still living in this way today. And he's been doing this now for maybe 30, 40 years or something like that. So imagine that. Isn't there something very powerful about that? Someone living that kind of life, never really talking to anyone. All you do is walk on arms round once a day to collect your food. Never really seeing anybody. Always contemplating the Dhamma, always meditating on your own. Most people go nuts if that happens. You're completely crazy here because you just can't handle it. I know for myself how easy it is to get, it's very easy to get deluded if you stay long periods in solitude. You have to be very careful. But there's something very powerful about that because it shows you a person like that would only be able to do that if he found something else, something more than we find in ordinary life. Not the ordinary sense pleasures, not the ordinary pleasures of company, of socializing, not the ordinary pleasures of power or of social status and all these kind of things. But there's someone who has something inside of themselves, something even more precious, even more powerful, that enables them to live that sort of life. I find it extraordinarily inspiring. Of course, Bodhinyana Monastery here in Perth is like a forest monastery in a sense. But this is just taking it to a completely different level, right? When you live completely by yourself, way off in the jungle like that. This is one example of somebody who I find is very inspiring, and it gives you a feeling that there's something more, right? There's something very powerful with this Buddhist teachings. Something that you find inside of yourself, which is more than the vast majority of people can normally find in ordinary life. So this is one example of that. Another example of that, of course, is Ajahn Brahm, when he went on a retreat about, I think, 10 years ago, he went on a 6-month retreat. Some of you may have heard about that. And I was at Bodhinyana Monastery at the time when that happened. And he basically just disappeared into this hut, and they didn't see him for 6 months. And then 6 months later he came out, and he was just all very, very happy, completely blissed out. He couldn't talk at all because he was so peaceful, right? And sometimes during those 6 months, I would bring the food to his kuti or to close to where he was. And I would just leave the food close to his kuti. And then when I had left, he didn't want to see me, right? So when I had left, he would come down and pick up his bowl. And nobody saw him for 6 months. He didn't see anyone for 6 months. The only thing he had was a tiny little hut of 7 square meters and a walking path outside. And that is where he spent his whole time for 6 months. And the only thing he did, apart from meditation practice, was to read some of the words, some of the suttas of the Buddha in the Majjhima Nikaya. Majjhima Nikaya is a collection of the discourses of the Buddha. That's all he did for 6 months. How would you go if you did that, if that's all he did for 6 months? How would you feel after a while? Just walking back and forth, sitting down and reading some discourses by the Buddha. That's all he ever do. And then, after 6 months, he said that was the happiest period of his life that he's ever had before. 6 months of bliss was the first talk that he gave after he came off that retreat.
And again, you realize there's something very powerful about that. Somebody who's able to live that kind of life, there must be a depth to their mind, there must be a stillness, a peace, a happiness, something very profound going on there. And that is why people who dwell in the forest in this way are worthy of being listened to. These people are the spiritual authorities of the world, precisely because they have something that we don't have. They have a peace, they have a happiness, they have an insight that normal people do not have. I should also mention also there's also a nun, a very inspiring nun as well actually, and her name is Tenzin Palmo. You may have heard of her. And she wrote a book later on called A Cave in the Snow, I think is the name of the book. And she spent, I think it was 3 years, living in a small cave in the Himalaya mountains, just meditating, right? The same kind of idea again, this ability to just withdraw from the world and find a different kind of otherworldly happiness. It's good to have that, to see that this is true, just as true for the nuns as it is for the monks, of course. So this is where spiritual authority comes from, right? This idea of showing that you have something that most people don't have. And of course, the interesting thing that if you ask any of these people, all the people that I know about who are the most kind of accomplished in meditation practice and insight, if you ask them who they respect in turn, who is it that they revere, who is it that they take as their spiritual authority, they will all say, the Buddha, right? The Buddha is their spiritual authority here. Now think about that. All the most accomplished people in the world, all the people who are the most peaceful, the most kind-hearted, the most beautiful people you can think about, the person they in turn revere is the Buddha. The Buddha is like the teacher of teachers, the teachers of the awakened ones, the teacher of all those who everyone else respects, right? It kind of puts the Buddha up another level yet again. So the Buddha is like the person behind all this, the one who started this whole thing we call Buddhism. And that, of course, is the reason why he is the spiritual authority above, beyond anything else, the highest kind of spiritual authority. In fact, there's a danger there. There's a danger when you think of the Buddha in that way, that we sometimes elevate the Buddha too much, right? We think, wow, if somebody, you know, if the most accomplished people in the world, if they in turn venerate the Buddha and see the Buddha as something special, the Buddha must be something absolutely astonishing. And this is what has happened throughout Buddhist history, is the idea of elevating the Buddha just a little bit too far. You elevate him to the point where he is like a god, or he is some kind of cosmic energy, or, you know, sometimes when you read some of the commentarial literature which talks about the Buddha, they say things like when he walks around, dust doesn't settle on his body, right? That kind of thing. And it's a bit like making the Buddha into something different, making the Buddha into something which is beyond the ordinary human condition, and making the Buddha into something that isn't really tangible anymore. You can't really relate to him, right? He's something other. He's something different from what we are. And that is always a very dangerous thing, because once you make the Buddha other, once you make him different, then you lose the connection to the Buddha. Then his teachings don't speak to us in the same way anymore. Then we don't have the feeling that we are, in a sense, in the same boat. We can actually learn from the Buddha in a very real sense. So this is a very dangerous thing. And sometimes people say to me, when I say this, they say, oh yeah, but the Buddha is special, right? I mean, we can't get away from that. But it's, yes, he is special, but he's special in the sense that he has taken the human potential and fulfilled and taken the human potential to its maximum. It is in that sense that he is special. He's not special in that he is not human anymore. He has taken the human potential to the maximum. That is the way that he is special. And in that sense, we are just like him. We too have that potential to take, possibility of taking our humanity to a different level and being different as a consequence. And this is important to remember that. The danger is not that we don't elevate the Buddha enough. The danger is always that we elevate the Buddha too much, So we lose our sense of connection with the Buddha. It's important that we have that connection, because only then does the Buddha speak directly to us. So, for me, when I read the word of the Buddha, I read some of the stories about the Buddha, the things that inspire me the most often are when the kind of the humanity of the Buddha comes out, when his compassion comes out, when his the way he deals with other people around him comes out. When you just read the Buddha's teachings, when you just read the story of the Buddha's life, it is often a bit too awe-inspiring. But when you see the Buddha in daily life, then I feel I can relate to him. And one of the stories that I like about the Buddha, this is found in the Vinaya, the monastic discipline. And this is a story where the Buddha is walking around to the dwellings in the monastery. And the Buddha would often go on a tour, he would kind of inspect the dwellings in the monastery. And as he was walking around from one place to another one, he would come to a dwelling where there was a sick monk. And this monk was very sick, he had dysentery. Dysentery is like when you have, your stomach is very bad and you have diarrhea, right? And you completely, it's like very kind of disgusting, right? Very kind of soiled and very kind of disgusting. Yeah. So the Buddha comes to him and he sees this monk completely soiled in this way. Yeah. And then he says to this monk, he says, what is wrong with you, monk? And the monk says, Bhante, I have dysentery here. And then he says, well, isn't there anyone to look after you? No, master, he says, or no Bhante, there is no one to look after me here. Why isn't anyone look after you? And he says, well, because I don't do anything for the other monks. They are refusing to look after me here. And then the Buddha says to Ananda, Ananda is the Buddha's attendant, was with him for a long, long time. The Buddha says to Ananda, Ananda, go and fetch some water and we will wash and clean up this monk. And then the Buddha and Ananda, Venerable Ananda together, they clean up the monk, wash him. Why? It's a disgusting job. This is dysentery. It's very unpleasant. They wash him, put on some nice robes, and they take him by the feet and by the head, lift him up and put him on the bed so that he is okay. And then the Buddha goes out to the rest of the monastic community and he says to the monks, why aren't you look after this bhikkhu? He's one of you. And the monk says, oh, he doesn't do anything for us, so we don't look after him. And then the Buddha says, you don't have a mother and father. You don't have anybody to look after you. If you don't look after each other, who is going to look after you? And then he says, whoever would look after me should look after the other monastics in the Sangha. This is what the Buddha is like, right? He's down to earth. He's compassionate. He looks after his fellow monks in the monastic community. There's a sense of beautiful conduct there. Exactly the type of conduct that would kind of uplifts me, and I feel I would want to do the same thing. And this is the kind of conduct that I can relate to. And this is the conduct which kind of makes the Buddha human in a very real way. And you feel inspired, and you feel like this, I want to emulate this particular type of conduct myself. So this I find is very inspiring. Another beautiful example from the suttas is where called the pavarna. The pavarna is a Pali word which means invitation. And every year the monks and the nuns, they come together and they invite each other. And the invitation is that if you have seen anything in my conduct which is inappropriate or has been wrong by body, speech or mind in any way, I open myself up for admonishment, right? It's a very beautiful thing that you do as a monastic. You open yourself up to your fellow monastics for admonishment. And then if there's anything you have done which is wrong, anybody is free to tell you that you've done something wrong. It's almost the exact opposite to what you do in the world, that you never open yourself up for admonishment. If somebody admonishes you, you defend yourself and you don't take these things. So this is almost the opposite of normal life. And of course the purpose of this is the idea that If someone admonishes you in all sincerity here, and they're able to point out a fault that you have, then that is a potential for you to grow, right? We're trying to get rid of these defilements. We're trying to grow in good qualities. Sometimes we can't see them for ourselves, so somebody else needs to point it out. And as it says in the Dhammapada, if somebody points out a fault in you that you haven't seen for yourself, it's as if somebody is pointing out a treasure, right? They're pointing out a treasure. If somebody points out your fault, think about the next time somebody points out a fault in you. Maybe they're pointing out a treasure. Why is that? Because it gives you the opportunity to grow and to go in a better direction. Of course, a lot of the criticism we get isn't really of that sort where it's very useful. But sometimes you get a feedback which is very useful. Occasionally that happens. And then it is worthwhile reflecting on. And in this particular sutta, this particular discourse, the Buddha says to the monastic community, this is the Buddha, this is the one who started the whole community. He's like the CEO of Buddhism, right? The head, the boss, the top man. He says to all his monks, he says, is there anything that you have seen in my conduct, body, speech and mind? And have you seen any flaws? Then I open myself up for admonishment. This is what the Buddha says, right? He's not aloof. He's not saying, okay, you guys do this because you are still defiled. I haven't gotten any defilements, you don't need to worry about me. He doesn't say that. He opens himself up as well. Isn't that a wonderful thing? How many CEOs and companies around say this kind of thing to their employees? Please, you know, if you see any fault in me, please let me know because I want to improve. I don't think you hear that very often in ordinary companies. So again, it's a beautiful example. It's something that I can relate to. And something which makes sense, right? The Buddha doesn't have any sense of self that he needs to defend. All he wants is to have a communication which is open and free. And even though he may not have had any defilements, even though he may have been quite flawless in his conduct, sometimes by opening yourself up, other people might perceive there is a problem. At least you can sort things out or whatever. So this is how the Buddha was relating to his fellow monastics. And the last incident, which I also found very interesting, and now we're moving a little bit away from the ordinary life and to understand in the deeper aspects of what it means to be a Buddha. And this is the occasion where a monk called Vakkali, and Vakkali was very ill, he was about to die. And because he was about to die, his last wish was to be able to see the Buddha before he passed away. So he sends a person out and he says to this person, please go to the Blessed One, to the Buddha, and ask him if he can come and see me before I pass away. And of course, the Buddha, being compassionate and kind, he obliges. And he walks all the way to this monk, right? And he sits down next to this monk and he says to the monk, do you have anything that you feel bad about because you're about to die? And the monk says, no, I have nothing that I feel bad about because I have lived a good life and I have nothing in terms of virtue that I feel bad about. Well, do you have anything else then that you don't feel quite happy about? Is there anything apart from your virtue that you're not happy about? And then he says, well, the only thing I'm not happy about, and that is why I asked you to come, Bhante, because I wanted to see the Blessed One, see the Buddha before I pass away. And then the Buddha says, why on earth do you want to see this physical body here? This physical body is nothing here. This Buddha, a Buddha, has got nothing to do with the physical body here. Whether you see the physical body here, it's not going to be of any benefit to you here. And then he says, a beautiful saying, that the one who sees the Dhamma, the one who sees or understands the teaching deeply, he or she is the one who sees the Buddha. The one who sees the Buddha is the one who sees the Dhamma. So this brings us back to this idea that what the Buddha really is, right? The physical body is not really important. In the end, it is the spiritual qualities of the mind that make someone a Buddha or an awakened one. So this is what we should all aspire to. So if we want to understand what the Buddha truly is, then every time you have a mind state where you feel more virtuous, more compassionate, then you know that this is, you're moving in the direction, you're feeling a little bit of what it means to be a Buddha, except that for him, of course, it is taken to the absolute maximum of what is possible to do. So this is then a little bit what it means to be a Buddha, right? And these things to me, they, when I read these things, I start to relate to the Buddha as a human being. And then when I relate to him as a human being, and then I read his profound teachings about the various aspects of the Dhamma, then I see those aspects of the Dhamma in a new light. And then, when the Buddha says, like in this, just talking about this idea of right view, that there is this world, there is the other world, in other words, there is rebirth, there is a life following after life, then I take that very seriously, because I know that this person is speaking to me in a very direct way. Now, one of the things here to understand this idea of rebirth, when you know, once you have this sense that people with great spiritual authority say that there is such a thing as rebirth, you start to think, I need to take this seriously. I can't just dismiss this out of hand, right? This is kind of the first thing that always occurs to me when I hear this kind of, I can't dismiss it anymore because people with great authority say these things. But there's something more to it. How can I develop this idea of what does it actually mean? Is it enough just to have the confidence that there is such a thing as rebirth? Or is this an idea that should be developed and should actually be made to grow inside of yourself so you get a real feeling for what this is like? And what I just want to talk very briefly about is, and this is something I talked about again a few weeks ago here, and this is the experience that one of the members here of the Buddha Society had while doing a past life regression. So past life regression is when somebody like hypnotizes you, right? And then they take you through hypnosis into memories that go beyond this life. And then during that hypnosis, you then speak and relate what seems to be, sometimes it isn't, sometimes it may be, it's a bit uncertain, but anyway, they try to do this, and sometimes you speak about those memories that you have from a past life, right? And this person told me, it was very, very interesting when he did this, because he remembered lots of details, right? What he did through this regression into past lives, he could remember his name, right? The name of his wife. He could remember what kind of occupation they were, what kind of house they were living in, what kind of background they have, how many kids they had, what the shape of the house were, all these kind of details, right? And of course, once you have a large number of details, it makes it very interesting because these things become checkable. You can actually find out whether there is any reality to this. And of course, that's because he found this quite extraordinary that he was actually talking about all these things as if there was a past life. That's what he did. He went to check out whether there had been such a person, whether he had had such and such a wife, such and such a house in the past. And what he found was that a large amount, maybe 95% or some, I can't remember the exact figure, but 95% of those things that he had memorized, that he had written down with great care, they kind of checked with a person who had existed, that was about 150 years ago, right? Back in the 19th century. And the facts fitted one after another in a very kind of amazing and surprising way. So what is going on here? Is this a real memory of a past life? And of course, once you see that one fact after another fits in this way, it becomes very difficult to dismiss this kind of memory. Because if you start to multiply, you start to look up at the probability, one thing is relatively improbable, right? Then you remember another thing, which also is relatively improbable. And then you add it all up. Actually, you have to multiply it, because that's how the mathematics of probability works. And after a while, the probability of remembering all these things and fitting with a random event in the real world is almost negligible. So it is very powerful. And he told me that when the more he looked at this, and the more he saw that the details actually fitted with the things that he had remembered, that he had written down during this past life regression, the more initially he was in denial. No, I don't want to, you know, I'm brought up as a Catholic. You know, we don't have anything about past lives in Catholicism. But after a while he started, and it took months for him to kind of to be able to digest this information. But after a while, he said, okay, I couldn't deny it anymore. I was forced to believe, or forced to have confidence in the idea of past lives. There was just too much coincidence that this could possibly have happened just through coincidence. And he said that this, and this is kind of the interesting part for me. The interesting part is not so much that there is a past life. I've had strong confidence in that for quite a while. But the interesting thing for me is the effect that this had on this person. And he told me that the first thing that happened was that once this started to sink in, he wanted to become even more moral, right? Even more kind, even more good-hearted. Already he was keeping the five precepts. Already he was doing the sort of thing that people in the Buddhist society he do. Already he was a very good person. But now he wanted to take his morality to another level. That was the first impact of this kind of certainty about past lives, right? The second thing he said to me, which was very fascinating, was that he said he was in the about to negotiate some kind of contract with some kind of company, and it was all very exciting, it all seemed very important, right? And it kind of, it was looking like his future was going to be very bright because of this and all these kind of things. And he said that after this regression thing, after having become convinced of the past lives, all of this started to matter much less. It wasn't so important anymore. And he said that what was happening here was that he could see that he was just following the tracks from the past. He was following the habits in the past life. In the past life, he had been a very poor peasant who had come from overseas, from Ireland. He had come to Australia, established himself in Australia with a farm and built himself up from pretty much nothing. This was in the middle of the 19th century, right? And he had striven very hard and worked very hard. And he felt very proud when he died that he had had such success with building himself up from nothing. But now he could see that in this life, it was the same pattern repeating itself, right? He was again striving really hard, working really hard to have a similar kind of success as he had in the past life. And suddenly he felt, I'm just following old habits. I'm just doing the same thing over and over again. I'm not actually having any freedom. All I'm doing is just, you know, going into this track of old habits. And that was enough for him to say, I don't want to do this again and again. I don't want to keep on following the old habits. And his desire to actually do that started to abate. And his attachment, his ideas about the importance of these things started to fall away. And then he said that if I had seen this earlier, he's now married and his wife finally expecting a child and all this kind of thing, so it's too late to kind of become a monastic. But he said, you know, if this had happened before I was married, this would have been the time where I would have seriously considered becoming a monastic, right? And this is the power. This shows you the power when you actually start to reflect about this idea of many lifetimes, of past lives, the idea of rebirth. This is what it does to you. So reflect on this. And this is what I mean by the idea of right view. It's not just a static thing which just sits there. Either you believe in it or you don't. It's something you develop, right? You reflect on this. What does it mean that there is rebirth? What is it actually, how does that relate to you? If you have done these things before in a past life, what does that mean for this life? And because he saw these things firsthand, he realized the kind of the power that this view actually has when you feel it firsthand properly for yourself. So you too, try to feel what it means. What does rebirth actually mean in an emotional way? What are the consequences of having feeling this view in a deep way? And when you feel it in that sense in a deep way, that is when it starts to have a power. That's when it starts to change your perspective. That's when it starts to move you away from this life, right? Suddenly this life isn't so important anymore, because this life is just a small little thing, part of something far, far vaster, far, far larger. And there's the large picture, suddenly, which starts to matter. And of course, that is why that he's told me that at this point, that is when I, you know, might have become a monastic if it wasn't for my life situation. Because a monasticism is just that, right? It's saying that this life isn't so important. It's the big picture that really matters. I'm happy to do something, to renounce a large part of this life, and to move into a monastic setting, which maybe, yes, I give up some of the happiness in this life, but at the same time, I'm looking for something larger, the bigger picture. So the idea here, the closeness, the idea of rebirth and the idea of monasticism are very closely related to each other again. because you have this large view. So this is just to show you the power of view, the power of the way we look at the world when it is done and reflected upon in a deep way. It's incredibly powerful. It has a potential to change the way we look at things, potential to change our whole course or how we live our lives. That is what these things can do. And just to bring us back to the beginning again, I started off by talking about the Noble Eightfold Path and saying that the Noble Eightfold Path starts with right view, right? The Noble Eightfold Path, it ends with the last two factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are right mindfulness and right samadhi, the right stillness of the mind. This is all about meditation practice, right? So the point here is that there is a link between right view and our meditation, because right view is the foundation which makes meditation possible. And if you read some of the other discourses of the Buddha, this is again quite fascinating. The Buddha says that if you want to do satipatthana practice, if you want to do meditation practice, it should be founded on two things. It should be founded on virtue, on goodness, right? On character, on who we are as people. And it should be founded on right view, or straight view is what he calls it. These are the two things. Of course, that meditation is founded on virtue or founded on character, I think is very obvious. You have to feel good about yourself. You have to feel happy in the here and now to be able for meditation to be possible, right? If you're not happy in the here and now, your mind is going to wander. You're going to think about things. You're going to be dull. You're going to have all kinds of things. If your mind is very pure and you're happy in the present because your conduct is good, your mind is naturally going to incline to the present moment. And that is when meditation becomes possible. So virtue, yeah, it is reasonably obvious to understand why virtue, not just virtue, your whole character, your whole being, your whole personality, why that is important for meditation. But the Buddha also said that view is also important, right? And this is what I've been trying to point out today, why view matters for meditation, why it matters for our whole life, how it gives us direction in everything we do. So when you're moving towards deep states of meditation, and this is what satipatthana, this is what right samadhi or deep meditation is all about, right? When we're moving towards that, deep meditation, we are basically, we're abandoning this world a little bit. We're almost becoming like monastics, right? Remember, a state of deep samadhi is a state we are overcoming all of what we call sensuality or sensual pleasures or the sensual objects of this world. You're abandoning this world, right? Now, to abandon this world, it is very helpful to have a view that helps you to do that and gives you the larger picture. So this view is, you can start to see now how powerful this view is. This view is a driver of the whole Buddhist path. And even if you want to have success in meditation, even for that, it is very important to have this view as a foundation stone. So, that is really all I want to say. So I'd just like to remind you to please, these are not kind of unimportant issues. Sometimes people say, oh, it doesn't matter so much what you believe. You know, you can believe in anything you like. You can kind of still move forward on the path. You can still practice meditation. Of course, there is some truth to that. But if you really want the meditation practice to take off, if you really want to have success on the Buddhist path, you have to put the foundation stones into place. And the foundation stones is this thing called right view. And the very important part of that is to have this sense of confidence that there are people who have seen something more. And one of the things that they have seen is this idea of rebirth, of life after life, essentially. Okay, so thank you very much.